All right, good evening, everyone, or good morning, if you're in another part of the globe. It is Thursday, July the 5th. This is Peter Klein coming to you live from beautiful Columbia, Missouri in the United States, from my office at the University of Missouri. And we're getting ready for the inaugural lecture of Austrian microeconomics. Many of you were there a couple of weeks, were with us a couple of weeks back when we did kind of a preview lecture in which I introduced the course, talked a little bit about why we're doing it, how it fits into the larger program, larger portfolio of courses offered through Mises Academy, and I won't rehash all of that tonight. That introductory preview lecture is available on the course website if you didn't get a chance to watch it yet. You might wish to do so at your convenience. This is not a very lengthy course. We have, let's see, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 meetings together. This is the first. We're going to discuss scarcity, choice, and value as the sort of most fundamental set of topics to our study of price theory or microeconomics, to use the modern jargon. And we'll continue at this time next week with exchange and demand. We have a week on price determination, then a one-week break, and then 3 more weeks on production, profit, loss, and entrepreneurship, and the theory of competition. So I'm very glad to have all of you with us here tonight. The format, as we've done before, is we have about an hour and a half blocked off for our discussion tonight. We certainly won't go any longer than that, but we may finish a little bit early. I'm going to give a sort of mini lecture here for about an hour or, about 45 minutes, between 45 minutes and an hour, followed by some Q&A time. We have quite a few folks with us today, and I'll try to answer as many questions as I can. During the talk, during the lecture part, feel free to post any comments in the chat window. If you want to ask a question just to me privately, you'll also see a little Q&A window beneath the chat window. And when I get finished with the lecture portion, I will turn to the questions and answer as many of them as I can. And, of course, even though we have these weekly meetings, the course continues, sort of running continuously during this 7-week period, meaning that you can ask questions on the website, you can email me privately at pklein@mises.org. You can certainly give me a telephone call, we can set up a Skype, whatever, if you want to just ask questions, express an opinion, or interact with me or with other course participants in any way that you see fit. So, again, we are going to focus over the next several weeks on what old-fashioned economists call price theory, the theory of valuation, exchange, production, and markets. Nowadays, in modern economic jargon, it's conventional to split things between microeconomics, the study of individual consumers and businesses and specific markets, and so-called macroeconomics, the study of the economy as a whole, inflation and unemployment and the business cycle and so forth. There are reasons why that isn't the best kind of terminology to use, but nonetheless, we're splitting our sort of intermediate level offerings into a micro half and a macro half, just following the conventional jargon. That's an easy way for us to organize this material. But, of course, Austrian economists have always emphasized the unity of economic theory and have tried to de-emphasize this notion of an artificial split between micro and macro. So, of course, we're going to talk during our so-called micro course about time, the passage of time, interest, capital structure, and incidentally, we'll make reference to business cycles and unemployment and other so-called macroeconomic phenomena. But our main focus is on the theory of value, exchange, price, and markets. So we start this week with, where else would you start? At the beginning. Right? We had a brief methodological discussion in our preview lecture. Why do we call this mode of analysis causal realist analysis? How does it differ from, say, positivism or empiricism or some other approach to the philosophy of science. I'm not going to recap all that here, but just jump right in. But certainly if you're interested in those key methodological issues, you should review the discussion that we had a couple of weeks ago. Okay, so, wrong button. Let's begin with what we mean by action, right? As I'm sure all of you know, Ludwig von Mises titled his famous treatise, Human Action. And of course, that's an unusual name for an economics book, right? Why does Mises emphasize action? What's the distinction between action and other kinds of behavior? Well, that's really where we need to start. Economics is, in a fundamental sense, the analysis of action, where action is defined in a very specific way. Mises, as many of you know, used the term praxeology as his label for the science of human action, the logical, deductive analysis of human action. That the term praxeology certainly hasn't caught on maybe the way that Mises had intended it to, but you still find Austrian economists referring to that term. What we mean in a sort of common sense way is simply the study of purposeful, by which I mean goal-oriented behavior, right? So the distinct characteristic of human action, as opposed to other things that might look like action, motion, is that human behavior is aimed at some purpose, right? When we, if I pick up my handheld device to make a telephone call, right? I mean, there's physical motion involved, right? There's this this smartphone, being lifted up and down. My arm is moving. At a biochemical level, right? There are all kinds of things going on in my head. There are electrochemical signals being sent by my brain. There's the whole physiology of arm movement and so on. As economists, we're not interested in that, right? We're interested in, kind of interpreting this physical motion as, well, Klein wants to make a phone call. He wants to communicate with his wife, and he picks up the phone and he dials the number, right? Animals move. I've got a picture of a cat. If you've ever seen a cat playing with a piece of string or some kind of a toy, I mean, they move, right? There's a lot of motion. A lot of it is kind of spastic, herky-jerky motion. But it isn't purposeful in the sense that, we can really kind of make sense of what aims or accomplishments the cat is trying to achieve. Right? A lot of animal motion is by instinct. But likewise, there's motion going on inside our bodies, right? I mean, as I'm speaking to you, I'm also breathing, and my eyes are blinking, and it's just a few hours after lunch, so there's probably some kind of digestion going on inside my stomach. I mean, that's movement, right? But that isn't action in the sense of anything that I've chosen to do to accomplish a purpose. Right, that's automatic. It happens in the background. Famous example that is different versions of which have been used by many economists is think of a phenomenon like the stock market. Imagine that you go to visit the New York Stock Exchange or the stock exchange in any country. The actual not an electronic market, but a physical stock exchange where people are in the room and they're making trades face to face. Imagine that you are an alien being from another planet, and you find yourself in a position to observe the New York Stock Exchange, maybe through a telescope, or you teleport there or something like that. And imagine that you are from a world that is so alien that you don't have any of the same concepts of markets and buying and selling. This is a completely alien phenomenon to you. And you're writing a report on what you see, or you're communicating back to your superiors what you have observed. Now, how would you describe it? Well, I mean, you'd say, all right, there's a big room, there's a big space, and there are these creatures, bipeds with two arms and two legs, and they wave their arms a lot, and they move their legs. They're frequently in motion throughout this room. you know, their mouths, this, you know, orifice is moving and sound is coming out. There are big screens with information on them. There are little white pieces of paper that are sort of, you know, jumping around all through the room. There's sort of a frenzy of motion. You could give a very accurate description of the purely physical aspects of what's going on in that room. But, you know, if this alien species lacks the concepts of, you know, buying, selling, price, profit, loss, you know, exchange of information, bidding, bids and asks, you know, they would have absolutely no way to make any sense of what they observe. It would just look like a bunch of motion. There's no way they could interpret what it means, right? In other words, it's impossible to sort of understand the New York Stock Exchange, the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, without trying to kind of, you know, put our minds, you know, put ourselves into the place of the actors and try to imagine, okay, why is that guy running from this place to this place? Why is he waving his arm trying to get the attention of that guy? Why are they throwing slips of paper at each other? What outcomes, what goals, what objectives are they trying to achieve? Once we understand the purpose of what's going on, it makes a lot more sense, right? So what we're interested in with human action is understanding or interpreting the action in terms of the objectives, the preferences, the means available to those people, you know, whom we are studying, right? You know, the goal of human action in a loose sense, right, is simply to, you know, improve one's circumstances, to bring about a state of affairs that is more desirable, that is preferable to the state of affairs that previously occurred, right? So, you know, the reason I pick up the phone to call my wife is because I want to communicate something to her, I want to have some interaction with her, and having communicated with her, I'm now in a better set of circumstances than I were before I communicated with her. You know, there's a lot of different kinds of language you can use for this. I had a desire to contact her. I felt the need to contact her. I had an urge to contact her. I rationally planned out that I wanted to contact her. It doesn't matter. Right? All of these are equivalent from a praxeological point of view. It simply means that I had some objective I wanted to achieve. And, you know, picking up the phone and dialing the number is a means for me to achieve that objective. You know, the term that Mises used in his, remember, English was not Mises' first language. Of course, Mises was fluent in English. But sometimes he chose modes of expression that are a little bit unusual. It generally sound unusual to our 21st century ears. You know, Mises talked about the desire to remove felt uneasiness. Right? You know, the reason I think that isn't the perfect way to describe why humans act is because it implies, you know, kind of like a psychological condition. You know, I feel uneasy, I feel uncomfortable, I feel awkward, I have an itch that I need to scratch. And that may be the case, but when Mises talks about the desire to remove felt uneasiness, he simply means the desire to bring about a more preferable state of affairs over a less preferable state of affairs, for whatever reason. We're agnostic about the reason, okay? Now, action has certain prerequisites, right? There are certain things that must take place or must be present for behavior to constitute action. So there are three of them, right? The actor's desire to improve the present situation, the ability of the actor to conceive of a preferred alternative, right? And finally, control over some kind of means to achieve this objective, right? So I have to want to be in a better state of affairs. I have to be able to imagine what this better state of affairs is, you know, what it could be, and I have to have the ability, at least I have to perceive that I have the ability to bring, you know, to bring about this better state of affairs. Right? So, you know, if I'm sitting around thinking, oh gosh, if only I had a Ferrari, my life would be so much better. I have this aching desire for a Ferrari. You know, my aching desire for a Ferrari is not action in this sense. Right? I mean, maybe I can conceive of what it would be like to drive a Ferrari, but I don't have the means necessary to bring that about. So, you know, bringing about that end is not kind of in the set of feasible actions that I can undertake, right? So likewise, if I'm totally ignorant about some opportunity that's outside my window, right? You know, right now walking outside my office door is, you know, the representative of the Missouri State Lottery, and he wants to hand me a check for $1 million if I'll just perform some trick, but I don't know he's there, he doesn't know I'm here. You know, I don't act, I don't rush to the door to open it and look for this guy if I don't know he's there. Okay, so for me to act requires that I have some knowledge that means are available that could satisfy my end. Right? I have to have the ability to conceive of what this alternative state of affairs could be. So I mentioned that only for those, those who worry that this sort of Mises logical deductive approach to analyzing human behavior doesn't take into account the role of knowledge and expectations and certain kinds of subjectivity. No, I mean, knowledge is built into the very foundations of action, right? Action implies knowledge that we can bring about a better state of affairs, knowledge of means, and so forth. So notice that action is not the same thing as preference, right? I mean, I can say I would prefer, a date with, gosh, I can't think of an example. I would prefer a date with Jessica Alba over a date with the librarian down here at the corner library. I mean, that may be a perfectly valid preference, right? But that isn't a prerequisite. That isn't a part of action because, well, shockingly, a date with Jessica Alba is probably beyond my means, not to mention the fact that my wife would be pretty unhappy about it. The reason I bring this up is, there's a lot of sort of misunderstanding about certain concepts in, you know, the Austrian theory of value, in particular the concept of indifference. And I'll come back to that a little bit later tonight because I want to talk about so-called indifference curves in neoclassical value theory and analysis of exchange. People say, well, but why do Austrians always say that you have to prefer one thing over another? That you can't be indifferent between one thing or another. You know, I like chocolate ice cream and vanilla ice cream exactly the same. I have no preference over chocolate ice cream or vanilla ice cream. I'm indifferent between them. You know, my response to that is, fine, great, wonderful. I'm so glad that in your mind, chocolate ice cream and vanilla ice cream provide exactly the same benefit. Who cares? Right? The purpose of economic analysis is not to explain preferences, but to explain action. Preferences are invoked in order to explain actions that are actually taken. Right? This is remember from last time, this is the realist part of so-called causal realist analysis. In other words, look, I mean, it may very well be the case that you have a whole range of preferences. You know, I like Jessica Alba better than I like, some other actress. I like Lamborghinis better than Ferraris. I mean, that's fine as dinner table conversation. Well, if you're a married man, the first one wouldn't be good for dinner table conversation. But anyway, it doesn't have anything to do with explaining, exchange and prices in the market, right? Because these are preferences that aren't acted upon. Is this a good way to describe economics? I mean, actually, technically speaking, Mises calls economics a subset of praxeology. So praxeology, Mises means, kind of the most general kind of formal analysis of action, which could include, exchange in a regime of property rights and so on, but you could also have a praxeology of violent action, a praxeology of warfare and so on. Most of us, economics is the most well-developed part of praxeology, and we often use praxeology and economic analysis as sort of loosely as synonyms. But this notion that economics is a formal, logical, deductive analysis of action, how does that compare to other definitions of economics that people commonly have? Well, one advantage of Mises' definition over, say, Adam Smith's, right? Adam Smith's idea that economics is the study of wealth, the science of wealth, you know, at the national level, the wealth of nations, to use Adam Smith's famous title, or even at the level of individuals. And the advantage of Mises' definition is that, of course, it has nothing to do with material well-being. It isn't specifically or exclusively about material well-being, right? People can have preferences for material things, but also for intangibles, immaterial things, right? It's more about choice and actions taken than about, you know, the specific character of, my screen just went to sleep there, which tells me I'm talking too long. You know, it isn't exclusively about material wealth. Lionel Robbins, very important early 20th century British economist who was close to Mises, participated in the Mises seminar in Vienna, wrote an important book in the 1930s, The Nature and Significance of Economic Science, where he offered a definition of economics that is typically adopted in contemporary textbooks. Something like, you know, the science of allocating scarce means among competing ends. And actually, that's a pretty good definition. That's pretty close to Mises' definition, one that I think is quite reasonable. Economics is about studying how people act and how they employ means to accomplish goals, as, you know, as that's how action is manifest. I bring that up only because some contemporary Austrians have criticized Robbins' definition as being too narrow. So, for example, if you read Israel Kirzner's very important 1973 book, Competition and Entrepreneurship, Kirzner distinguishes explicitly between what he calls Rubinsian maximizing, this notion that human action is about, you know, kind of maximizing behavior, meaning allocating, finding the optimal allocation of scarce means to achieve our ends, and some other mode of behavior, what Kirzner calls alertness to opportunities. And I mean, I sort of understand the point that Kirzner is making in context, but by no means does Robbins' definition, or the notion that people are, you know, presented with a set of scarce means, and then they have a given set of objectives, and they try to achieve those objectives with the most effective use of their means. By no means does that preclude imagination and creativity and subjectivity and so forth. No one is saying, Mises is certainly not saying, and Robbins wasn't saying either, that you know, the set of means is sort of exogenously given to us, and that, you know, we're sort of given a preference ordering and given a set of means, and finding the optimal allocation of those means is some kind of a trivial computational problem. That, of course, isn't what Mises means at all, because we're free to choose our preferences. Preferences that just exist subjectively in our heads. They can be whatever we want them to be. But, of course, the set of means that are available to us is, in some sense, constrained. Right? That doesn't mean that we can't use our imagination and our creativity to innovate, to combine resources in ways that hadn't previously been discovered or thought about, to make something a means that wasn't previously a means, like you know, in computing devices, you know, silicon. But silicon wasn't a valuable resource in the way it is now until people figured out how to use it, you know, to make integrated circuits. So by no means are we saying that means are somehow exogenously given, right? But at the moment of choice, the actor is taking the means that are available and figuring out how to use them in a way that satisfies the actor's ends, you know, in the best way possible. I'll elaborate on that in just a second. Okay, what about scarcity? The very notion of action, right, implies that, you know, we can't sort of have everything that we want without acting, right? So, you know, time spent communicating with my spouse is, in a sense, scarce, meaning that there isn't an infinite supply of it. And, you know, I wouldn't have picked up the phone to call my wife if, you know, if I could instantly communicate with her, you know, mentally through telepathy or something like that, right? Time spent with people is not super abundant. You know, there's only so many hours in the day. Time is a scarce resource. You've got to figure out some way to allocate the time that you have, right? So obviously when we talk about scarcity in this sense, we simply mean that, you know, resources are not super abundant. Or, put differently, we cannot simultaneously satisfy all of the ends that we wish to, that we wish to satisfy. I.e., we have to make some choice, right? We have to make some choices at the expense of others. We have to choose to satisfy one end at the expense of some other end that we could have been, that we could have satisfied. So obviously, we don't mean, the kind of natural resources definition of scarcity, like, there's oil is a scarce resource and we're going to run out of it soon, so we should all drive electric cars or something like that. Right, so we don't mean that we're running out of this thing, we might be, but all we mean by scarcity in the economic sense is that there is a finite amount of this resource available to us, right? What do we mean by economic goods, right? What are economic goods that we analyze in doing price theory? What are the things that we trade? What are the things that are priced and so on? Well, economic goods are simply the means, the concrete specific means that are used to satisfy particular ends. Right, so even the protesters in this funny picture that I found on Google Images, right, wanting people not to consume and to stop buying stuff and all that. I mean, like, these people are using scarce resources to achieve desired ends, right? I mean, there's only 24 hours in the day, and they have chosen to spend, let's say 5 hours holding up these silly signs and protesting, as opposed to spending those 5 hours in pursuit of some other objective, like smoking weed or, planting organic crops, or I don't know what these people do, probably not bathing, but the signs that they have, right? I mean, they only have a certain amount of money to spend on buying signs and paint or markers or whatever, and then decided to use the resources that they have to make these signs and not some other signs, right? They could have written other words on these posters, but they chose to write these words and use these colors and paint the letters in this way as opposed to some other way. They chose to stand on this particular street corner, wherever it was, as opposed to some other street corner, right? So they couldn't protest against all things that make them angry, in all possible locations at all possible times. I mean, that isn't feasible, right? So they had to make choices. They had to employ their time and their bodies and the money that they had and the scraps of paper that they had and so on to do this specific protest, as opposed to some other kind of protest that they could have done. So, of course, they're employing scarce means to achieve desired ends, just like, the Walmart shopper filling his or her basket with, goodies from Walmart, this kind of stuff that makes these people mad. Now, all things are not economic goods, right? For something to be an economic good, or to have what Karl Menger called goods character, there are certain requirements that have to be met, right? Limitation. There has to be a finite amount of it, right? So, air. Air for most of us in most circumstances. Air is not an economic good because it's super abundant. You can have as much as you want just by sucking it in, right? So people want it, right? But you don't have to we don't meter it and price it because it's all around us. Now, of course, that's all contextual. Right, if you're a deep sea diver at the bottom of the ocean with a little air tank, right, for you, air is a scarce resource that you have to allocate very carefully. As anything in outer space or whatever, you nerdy science fiction fans, some of you have probably read Robert Heinlein's great novel, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, about, people who've colonized the moon. And then for them, air really is a scarce resource, and they have markets for air, and the air is all priced, and, breathing isn't free, and so forth. There are other kinds of goods and of course, the good also has to be desirable, right? Certain kinds of bacteria or viruses, they may be super abundant. We can have as much of them as we want, but of course, we don't want them. We'd rather not have them. Right, so an economic good has to be something desirable, and it also has to be finite in its quality, in its quantity. Excuse me. Now there are two different categories of economic goods: consumer goods and producer goods. Right, so by consumer goods, we just mean goods that we can consume directly. You know, they directly satisfy a particular end that we want to achieve. Producer goods are those that indirectly serve a particular desire, right? If my end is to call my wife, right, then, you know, the BlackBerry is, this is not, holding the BlackBerry in my hand, you know, putting it up against my ear and, you know, feeling the way that the screen feels against my ear, it's actually not a very pleasant sensation. That's not the reason that I'm picking it up, right? The BlackBerry is simply a means to the objective of, you know, communicating with my wife. So, you know, this is an intermediate good for me, right, which is, I use to satisfy, it enables me to communicate with my wife. A machine in a factory, right? The machine that manufactures BlackBerries. People don't consume these machines, but they, you know, they consume the things that are made by these machines. So, you know, we often talk about sort of the original factors and intermediate factors, original nature-given factors. Those are labor and land, right? Meaning we don't sort of produce more of them. They're God-given or nature-given. Now, we have to be careful what we mean by that. I mean, we do, in a sense, produce human beings by reproducing. That's not the sort of thing that we have in mind here. And of course, people always say, yeah, but you can make more land, just like the Dutch, you know, filled in the, they made more land by filling in the, creating more land in Amsterdam. I was just recently in San Francisco, and a lot of San Francisco was expanded into the bay. In fact, the neighborhood where I used to live many years ago, sort of the hip Italian neighborhood, increasingly Chinese now, in San Francisco, is called North Beach. But there's no beach there. I mean, it's several miles away from, or at least a mile away from, the actual water. In the 19th century, what's now North Beach in San Francisco was that was water's edge. Right, but then they subsequently, dredged and filled in the bay to make more land. That isn't what we mean by calling labor and land original or primary factors of production. What economists mean by land is not just physical dirt, right, but any part of the natural environment that, you know, is here whether we want to use it or not, right, that we don't have to produce but is given to us. So that includes, minerals, the productivity or fertility of the land, and so forth, natural resources in the broadest sense. Okay, so labor and natural resources are kind of given to us by nature, but machines and factories and vehicles and so on are things that we have to produce, that we create using land and labor. Okay, so, this distinction between consumer goods and producer goods, of course, we could make it lots of stages instead of just two categories, right? We talked about this a little bit in the preview. Menger used the terminology of higher order goods and lower order goods, right? The lowest order being the stuff that we consume, consumer goods, we consume directly. And then the things that produce those consumer goods are at a higher level or are of a higher order than consumer goods. And then the things that are used to produce those producer goods are at yet a higher level still, and so forth, right? You know, you eat a piece of bread, satisfy your hunger, bread's a consumer good, the oven and the wheat, the flour and the water and the oven and so on, those are at a higher level than the bread. Those are higher order goods relative to the bread. But the grain and the tractor and the machines used to make the oven, those are at a yet higher level than the flour in the oven. And then the things that are used to make the tractor are at a higher level still. And if we could, in theory, we could trace that all the way back to, the human laborer that, put together the first, grabbed some sticks off the ground and made them into some kind of a tool that could be used to dig or whatever. Okay. By the way, what we mean by capital in this context, strictly speaking, is, capital goods that can be, parceled out into discrete pieces and bought and sold on markets, right? So you know, we often, especially in modern economics, contemporary economics, people have kind of stretched the term capital to mean more than simply capital goods, machines and tractors, and, you know, sacks of flour and so on that can be bought and sold in market, but a kind of a more general notion of stuff that is used to do other stuff, like, you know, the concept of human capital made famous by Gary Becker and Theodore Schultz, right? Human capital meaning education, skills, knowledge that we have in our heads that enables us to produce more stuff, to do more things, to satisfy more ends. Right? It's sort of analogous to saying that, you know, just as a farmer with a hoe can only plant so much wheat and ultimately make so much bread, if the farmer has a big fancy machine, a combine harvester, more capital goods, you know, the same farmer can produce much more bread, right, than he can with fewer or simpler implements and tools. So people say, likewise, you know, a worker without education can produce, you know, this much stuff, but if you give the worker education, if you give the worker skills, if you give your worker experience, then that same worker can produce even more of, you know, the thing that the worker is producing. So, you know, knowledge is like capital in that sense. We don't necessarily consume the knowledge directly. I mean, we might get some intrinsic satisfaction from possessing it, but mainly, you know, we like knowledge because it allows us to do a bunch more stuff. So-called social capital, the people you know, the networks that you have, the relationships that you form, those also increase your productivity. But strictly speaking, human capital and social capital, they're not capital goods in the praxeological sense, because you can't separate them from the human being. Right? You can't buy and sell knowledge. You can buy and sell books. You can buy and sell lectures. You can, you can hire a consultant and so forth. But it's not the knowledge that's being traded directly. It's the book or the lecture or the consultant services or whatever. Likewise, relationships can't be bought and sold on the market. So, you know, human capital and social capital, you can think of them as capital in a kind of a loose metaphorical sense, if you like, and that's fine. But strictly speaking, they're not capital goods, the way a sack of flour is a capital good, or a machine is a capital good. Okay. What about time? Well, we haven't talked explicitly about time, but time is implicitly in everything that we've been talking about, right? I mean, action implies the passage of time, right? Because, you know, if I pick up the phone to call my wife, it's because I think that the state of affairs after I have called her is preferable to the state of affairs before I have called her. So action takes place through time, and time, as we mentioned before with our protesters here, time itself is a scarce resource. We only have so many hours in the day. We have to choose to allocate them to activity A over activity B. Okay? And many of you have heard the term that Austrian economists use in the context of interest theory, the notion of time preference. But time preference simply means that people prefer to satisfy a need sooner rather than satisfying the same need later. Right? I mean, if speaking to my wife at some indeterminate future point were just as valuable to me as speaking to her now, well, then I would never call. Right? I mean, I'd just wait till that future moment when we happen to interact. Right? The very notion of action implies that you want to bring about the desired end now, as opposed to, you know, waiting an infinite amount of time when it might, you know, occur on its own. Okay, so people prefer the same thing sooner, something sooner over the same thing later. Okay. One additional note about scarcity, right, is that, and this is already implied in our discussion about capital goods or producer goods, right, that, you know, to get most of the stuff that we want, we can't just pick things to consume directly. We typically do need some intermediate goods, some production goods, some producer's goods, some capital goods, to get most of the stuff that we want, right? I mean, you can imagine Robinson Crusoe living on an island, and there's, you know, fruit that's just falling from the trees, and the only thing he has to worry about the only way he deals with scarcity is, you know, okay, do I walk over here and pick up the banana, or do I go over here and pick up the coconut? I mean, Robinson Crusoe does act, right? He only has certain number of hours in the day to devote to eating. He can't simultaneously eat the banana and the coconut. He has to choose and so forth. But, you know, if the food is just there, then he doesn't have to worry about, you know, planting it or catching the fish or digging it up, right? It's sort of just, he only has to worry about choosing one consumer good over another consumer good. You know, in most cases, the world isn't like that. Of course, we have to, if we want, you know, a banana, we have to plant the banana tree, and we have to have a machine to harvest the banana, or a ladder to climb up there, and a knife to chop it down, and so forth. We can't just expect the fish to jump into our frying pan, or even the frying pan's capital, right? Jump into our mouths, like a sushi. We have to have a net to catch the fish, or a fishing pole, and we have to have some implements to clean the fish and cook the fish, and so on. Okay, so to achieve most of our ends, we've got to produce something. But notice an implication of scarcity here. Production is not the creation ex nihilo. It's not creating something out of nothing. In a technical sense, it's really just sort of rearranging, combining, recombining, transforming the existing factors of labor and land. Okay? So, you know, we have these nature-given factors, land and labor. We transform them into something else that we can then use to produce. Okay, so Crusoe, you know, he finds a stick on the ground, and he finds a piece of rock, and he, you know, uses the sharp rock to whittle the stick and make it into a spear or whatever. You know, if you want to think about this in chemical terms, there's only so many atoms in the universe. Only so many Higgs bosons. I don't even really know what the Higgs boson is, but everybody's talking about it today. The amount of matter is sort of finite. So it's not like we can just sort of think up a new thing and it comes into existence like in some cheesy sci-fi movie. Right? We're sort of rearranging atoms in a sense. This takes time, right? And it often proceeds in stages, and, you know, we'll be talking later in this course about production theory in more detail. And if you take Joe Salerno's follow-up course on, you know, business cycles and so forth, you'll learn a lot more about the Austrian approach to the stages of production. Okay, so how do we get from this to choice and valuation? Well, it's pretty simple. Right, scarcity necessitates choice. I can't have the banana and the coconut at the same time. I got to choose one or the other. The fact of my choosing implies that I prefer one outcome to the other. Right? So the very notion of action implies valuation, that you value the state of affairs that you think will be brought about by your action more highly than the state of affairs that you think will occur in the absence of your action, or if you had chosen some alternative action. Okay? So, as Mises would say, you know, human action is always preferring one thing and setting another aside. We're faced with this huge array of choices. The very fact of action is expressing a preference for something over something else. Now, of course, this valuation is subjective. Right? The fact that I eat the banana when I could have eaten the coconut tells me that the satisfaction I expect to receive from eating the banana exceeds the satisfaction I expect to receive from eating the coconut, and that's it. Right? It does not mean that bananas are objectively good for you in some sense or bad for you. It doesn't mean that you are, you know, rational to choose the banana as opposed to the coconut. It just means you chose the banana. Why? I don't know. Maybe you like the taste better. Maybe you think a banana is more fun to eat. You enjoy peeling the banana. It reminds you of, you know, the movie Jungle Book, which was your favorite movie when you were a kid. I mean, who knows and who cares, right? All we're interested in is the fact that you preferred the banana. Why you preferred it, that's a question for psychology, not for economics, right? Of course, we don't mean anything more than, you know, the way I've just described it. You know, I talked to a lot of people who are fans of Ayn Rand, and Ayn Rand called her movement objectivism, and she didn't like, you know, subjectivists and people who think that values ultimately are subjective. Right? Again, value here just means banana over coconut. It's not talking about morality, not talking about, you know, science or, you know, the nature of the good. It doesn't have anything to do with that. Okay, so followers of Ayn Rand are also subjectivists in this sense that, you know, they have a copy of Atlas Shrugged in front of them and a copy of The Fountainhead in front of them, and they choose to pick up Atlas Shrugged instead of The Fountainhead. Right, we would say, well, that's because they have expressed a subjective preference for, at this very moment, reading a few pages from Atlas Shrugged as opposed to reading a few pages from The Fountainhead. It doesn't make them any less, doesn't mean they aren't objectivists in Ayn Rand's sense of the word. Right? And of course, we aren't we're completely agnostic about religion and, you know, and ethics and so on. It doesn't have anything to do with that. Right? We're simply saying that we take, as economists, we take people's preferences as given. For whatever reason, they prefer A over B. Okay? That preference cannot be broken down into some scientific factors that we can express with a set of equations. Maybe at some physiological brain chemistry level, somebody can explain that, you know, using scientific methods. But as economists, we're not interested in that, right? We're simply interested in the fact that people choose for whatever reason, okay? And again, valuation is always ordinal rather than cardinal. You know what these words mean? Ordinal means there's sort of a ranking. A is better than B, B is better than C, C is better than D. It does not mean that, you know, A is equal to, A has a value of 10, B has a value of 5, such that A is twice as good as B, right? Human action is not like that, right? Human action is, our preferences are ordinal in the sense that we only know that picking up the copy of Atlas Shrugged is better than picking up the copy of The Fountainhead, you know, for that person in that situation. Is it twice as much better? 10% better? 30% better? I mean, it doesn't even make sense to ask that question. It's sort of a meaningless question. Plus, if you, you know, talk about intangibles, right? I mean, you know, you love your spouse or your girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever. How much do you love them? 10? 5? I mean, that doesn't make any sense, right? You say, well, I love my wife more than I love some other woman. Okay, twice as much more? 22.6% more? It's just more, right? There's no notion of numbers. There are no cardinal numbers that are attached here. Which, by the way, notice, a little preview, when we go over value scales in just a few minutes. You know, Austrians don't talk about, the highest ranked end is 10, and the next end is 9, and so forth. They often use letters A, B, C, D to remind us that these are ordinal, not cardinal. Or they'll say first, second, third, right? So, you know, my second favorite thing, is it half as good as my first favorite thing? Who knows, right? It doesn't even make sense to ask that. So we have this idea that, you know, when people act, they have demonstrated that they prefer the action they took over the action they could have taken but didn't. And so we can imagine that people have sort of a scale of values, right? Different things that could be accomplished using particular economic goods, and that they have some kind of a ranking. For example, here's three examples that I shamelessly pilfered from my good friend Professor Salerno from a lecture series that he did. Imagine that Robinson Crusoe, he has 12 hours during the day to work. I guess he sleeps 12 hours a day. Maybe this is teenage Robinson Crusoe. And imagine that with those 12 hours of labor, you know, here are the things that he could do. He could catch 4 fish. He could pick 8 coconuts from the trees. He could harvest 5 pounds of wild mushrooms. He could spend 4 hours swimming and sunbathing. He could build a hammock. Okay? Let's suppose that, you know, his his number one choice, if he has only 12 hours of labor, his preference is to spend those 12 hours trying to catch the four fish, rather than the 8 coconuts or the 5 pounds of mushrooms and so forth. So he takes these possible uses of a day's worth of labor, and he ranks them. He rank orders them, right, such that he could express a preference for one over the other. And again, we're not saying that getting 8 coconuts is only half as good as getting 4 fish. We just mean that it's the next best thing to catching 4 fish. It could be an amount of money. I have $10,000. A student gets $10,000 for graduating from college. Or you could use that for a fancy vacation. You could use that to buy a car. Actually, I don't know how you could use that to buy, certainly not a new car. These must have been examples that Salerno thought about in 1975. But anyway, a used car, let's say, or a toy car, you could save that money for grad school, or you could use it to party and so forth. Right? These are several different uses of $10,000. And if we observe that a college student got $10,000 and went to Europe, that taking a European vacation is the highest ranked item on their value scale. Okay? Now, notice a couple of things about presenting it this way. First of all, we're speaking in reference to how specific units of economic goods could be allocated. Right? So what are the things I can do with 12 hours of labor? This, 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 and this. What are the things I could do with $10,000? This, 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 and this. We're not making a fantasy ranking. Okay? When I was in California, there with my family a couple weeks ago, we were in LA, and I took the kids to drive around Beverly Hills, and we saw a bunch of cars. And I've got a teenage son; he's really into cars. I was into cars when I was, at that age. And we would, as we were driving down the road in our rented minivan, we're saying, "Oh, there's a Bentley, there's a Lamborghini, there's a Rolls Royce." We even saw a Bugatti Veyron. Those of you car nuts will be impressed with the Bugatti. I think it costs about $1.5 million. It's pretty impressive to see in person. And, we would say, well, my son and I would say, well, which do you like the best? If you can have any one of these cars, which one would it be? Ooh, gosh, I think I'll choose the Lamborghini. The Bugatti is a little flashy for me. Whatever. That doesn't economics. I mean, it doesn't have anything to do with preference scales. In the sense that Menger described, or Mises would talk about, or Rothbard described, right? So I can't have any of those cars. So there is no way for me to demonstrate my preference for one of those cars over another, because not one of them is feasible for me, okay? So, again, we're talking about, we're thinking about ends here, right? How do I rank these means that could be used to satisfy a particular end? Everything's ordinal. Right? And I'm sorry, I've got a, as I said, it's like with love, right? I mean, you love the person you marry more than the person you considered marrying but didn't. But there's no way to attach numbers to that. You don't love one person equal to 5 and another person equal to 6 and another person equal to 1. Ends can be intangible, right? I mean, I can choose to, as a professor, right, I get a lot of lobbying from students to change their grades, right? So I can choose, if I change somebody's grade in response to whining, I achieve the end of, getting this annoying person out of my office, and I get some peace and quiet. But I might have to sacrifice a little bit of my integrity, right? So if I say no to this student, I will not change your grade. This is the grade that you earned, and whatever. I'm demonstrating a preference for integrity, and being, having a reputation as a tough grader over the competing end of peace and quiet, and having the student go away and not bother me anymore. So rankings can be over intangible outcomes, not just tangible things. Mainstream economists like to talk about maximizing things, borrowing the language of 19th century physics, optimizing and maximizing and so on. If you want to say that, fine. I mean, maximizing utility in the causal realist way, causal realist sense, just means choosing the highest valued end on your preference scale. So the college student who took the $10,000 and used it to go to Europe, as opposed to saving it for graduate school, you know, maximized his or her utility. Calling it that doesn't really add any insight, and I think it's more likely to be misleading than helpful, but if you want to use that terminology, fine. That's all that maximizing utility means in this sense. Again, we're not making any statements about, you know, selfishness in kind of an ethical way, saying that people allocate their scarce means to their highest valued end doesn't mean they're bad people or good people. You could put, if I were to, somebody is pointing a gun at my child and I jump in front of the child and take the bullet myself, right, that simply means I demonstrate my preference for sacrificing my own health and life, you know, to protect my child over having the bullet possibly hit my child. You could say that's an act of self-sacrifice. Who cares? Whatever. We're trying to explain why I jumped in front of the bullet. It's because I value protecting my child, even if it means my own death, over having my child be hurt. So my preference ordering can include I can have somebody else's well-being ranked higher than my own well-being. That's perfectly fine. And notice, we're completely agnostic here about rationality, as that term is used in behavioral economics and by psychologists and so on. They say, well, spending that money on a European vacation, you know, psychologically, that is not as good for you as spending that money, you know, saving that money for grad school, or maybe the other way around. You know, you have to have these life experiences to make you a well-rounded person. We're not saying anything about rationality in that kind of sense. And notice, by the way, that people choose optimally, in our sense, at the moment of choice. Right, I mean, you can offer me, you know, today I might choose the banana over the coconut, and then tomorrow I choose the coconut over the banana. You know, some neoclassical economists will say, that's irrational, because your preferences aren't consistent. If you prefer bananas yesterday, then other things equal, you should prefer bananas today. Your preferences are inconsistent somehow. Austrians wouldn't have any problem with that whatsoever. Right, preference is always demonstrated in action at the moment of choice, and it's not irrational to express a difference, to have a different valuation at some other moment of choice. Now, thinking about scarcity, thinking about choice, leads us to some notion of, you know, profit and loss, right? Gain or error. Okay, so profit in this sense doesn't just refer to money. I mean, you certainly could have money profit and loss, but think of a more general notion of psychic profit, right, as being, you know, the difference between the benefit, the value of having the thing that you chose over the value of the thing that you gave up or that you could have chosen but didn't. I don't want to say difference because that implies, you know, some quantities that can be subtracted. No, the psychic gain from taking an action is, you know, the fact that now you have achieved the objective that you, at least in an ex ante sense, wanted to achieve. You're now in the state of affairs that you hope to bring about rather than the state of affairs that existed prior to action. So all action generates a profit ex ante in this simple sense. Right, so all action is profitable by definition, in the sense that action is choosing the thing you prefer over the thing you didn't prefer. Right, but that doesn't mean that people can't experience a kind of ex post regret. Okay, you know, I just finished eating that banana, and damn it, I all of a sudden remembered I like coconuts better than bananas. What was I thinking? Okay. That's fine. People have ex post regret all the time. The buyer's remorse and I wish I hadn't done this. I wish I could have done something else instead. But remember, the goal of economic analysis in causal realist theory is not to explain kind of psychological states of well-being. Am I happy? You know, am I leaning back in my bamboo chair, rubbing my belly, thinking, oh, that banana was good. I'm so happy. As opposed to thinking, oh, why didn't I get the coconut? The goal of economics is not to explain how you feel after you made a choice. It's to explain choice. And ex post regret is not helpful in explaining the choice that you just made. Now, from a kind of situational analysis, as at doing applied economics or historical analysis, if I'm trying to think, what do I think Klein's going to do the next time? The fact that he chose a banana and didn't choose a coconut, and then he felt bad about it, that helps me, you know, as an analyst, as a forecaster, to try to think, well, maybe he's going to go for coconut the next time. But from a purely praxeological point of view, the fact that I felt bad after I didn't does not invalidate the fact that I made a choice and that I chose one thing and, you know, set aside another. You know, the fact of choice is fundamental, as anybody who's seen the Matrix trilogy, of course, will understand. Okay, a couple more things before we stop for some questions. We can speak a little bit more precisely about the concepts of utility and marginal utility as they appear in causal realist analysis. You know, this kind of discussion is often motivated by the famous paradox of diamonds and water that was discussed by Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, strangely, because he had, you know, as sort of a great puzzle, which is weird because he had solved the paradox in his lectures on jurisprudence in 1767. In 1776, he describes it as a great paradox in The Wealth of Nations, you know, namely, water is very important. Water is essential for human life. Diamonds are just kind of a frivolous luxury. Yet on the market, the price of water is much higher than the price of diamonds. The other way around. The price of water is much lower than the price of diamonds. Why is water, which is so valuable, so cheap, but diamonds, which are, you know, frivolous, why are they so expensive? Why is their price so high? If we think seriously about subjective value and marginal analysis, this problem is easily solved, right? The subjective part is straightforward, right? I mean, it doesn't matter what people, it doesn't matter if the physiological characteristics of water are unimportant. It's how people feel about water and, you know, how much water they want and so forth. But we can easily solve this problem by thinking about utility the way Menger did it. And Menger provided the correct solution, was the first to provide in explicit detail the correct solution to Adam Smith's diamonds and water paradox. I'll come back to diamonds and water on the next slide. But a little terminology. By the term utility, as Menger uses it, of course he uses a German word, but a German word that we translate as utility, is the notion, utility is the value that comes from employing a particular means, using a particular economic good to satisfy an end. But the concept of marginal utility, by the way, a term that Menger doesn't use, it's Menger's successor and student, Friedrich von Wieser, who first introduces the term marginal utility in German. But the concept is in Menger. Marginal utility, think of that as the utility or benefit from a marginal unit of a scarce mean. Or, put differently, it's the value of the highest ranked end that cannot be achieved if the unit of this scarce means is lost. Okay? Look at this, look at what I have on the bottom of the slide. Hypothetical value scale for Robinson Crusoe on an island. For sacks of wheat. Okay, so imagine that Robinson Crusoe has this preference ordering, this value scale, over sacks of wheat. Right? If he only had one sack of wheat, he would use it to bake bread so that he could sustain his life. Okay, if he had two, then he'd still be hungry, but at least he'd be alive. If he had two sacks of wheat, well, he would use the first to make bread that is necessary for survival. But then after that, he would go ahead and make a second loaf of bread because it tastes good, and he'd, you know, be even better shape, he'd be healthier if he has a second loaf of bread. I guess this is pre-Atkins. This is not the primal Robinson Crusoe. If he has three sacks of bread, well, three sacks of wheat, he'll make a loaf of bread out of the first and eat it to prevent starvation. He'll make a loaf of bread out of the second and use it to feel good, to feel satiated. Then he'll, with a third, he will use that to plant, he'll plant those seeds so that he can have wheat, you know, next year. If he has enough for all of those things, then he has, if he has a fourth stack of wheat, he'll use that to feed his farm animals and so forth. Okay? Somebody in the chat window has been talking about scotch, so here you go, you can make vodka or grain, some kind of whiskey out of a fourth stack of wheat. Not vodka, that would be, you'd make that out of potatoes. Anyway, you get the idea. So what's the utility of a sack of wheat? The answer is, well, it depends how many sacks of wheat you have. All right, so if Robinson Crusoe has six sacks of wheat, he can satisfy all six of these desired ends. But let's say, this example used by Maynard, that you know one of his sacks of wheat is destroyed by mold or rats eat it or something. He realizes, he wakes up one day and instead of six, he only has five sacks of wheat. Well, he's not going to feed his pets and make some booze to drink and so forth and starve to death. Right? He's not going to satisfy his sixth need before he's satisfied the first five. Okay. So if he has six sacks of wheat and he loses one, he's going to forego the sixth highest valued use. And then if he loses the fifth sack, he'll forego the fifth highest valued use and so forth. Right? So the value of any particular sack of wheat depends on what? It depends on how many sacks of wheat you already have. Right, so if you have six and you lose one, well then the value of that sack of wheat is the foregone value of being able to feed your, you know, your little kitty cat. Okay, so that's the marginal utility of the sixth loaf, sorry, the sixth sack of wheat. It's a tongue twister. The sixth sack of wheat is the value foregone from making, you know, Fluffy a happy kitty cat. If you only have four sacks of wheat, then the marginal utility of that fourth sack of wheat is the benefit for being able to feed your farm animals and then being able to have eggs and milk and meat and so forth. Okay? So what do you notice? You notice that the more sacks of wheat you have, the lower the value of the marginal sack, simply because it's being allocated to a lower value use. Okay? This is really an important distinction. Those of you who have studied neoclassical economics, right? Those of you who have studied utility theory and marginal utility theory as expressed by the mainstream in mathematical terms. So, well, you know, total utility is some quantity, and then marginal utility is the rate of change of total utility, and you have a function, and you can use calculus to take the derivative. Marginal utility is the first derivative of total utility. That's not the case. That doesn't make sense in Menger's approach, right? For Menger, the term marginal applies not to the utility, but to the units, right? So the marginal utility of the fourth sack of wheat is the utility of the marginal sack of wheat, in that case, the fourth. So marginal utility is the utility of the marginal units, not the marginal utility of a unit. Okay, so notice, by the way, that we're assuming, you know, a quantity of wheat for Menger is, a supply of wheat is homogeneous units, right? So the idea is there are six sacks of wheat which are otherwise identical, okay? So you have to have a stock of a homogeneous good to begin with before you can even talk about marginal utility. So the law of diminishing marginal utility is the claim that, you know, ceteris paribus, other things equal, as the supply of the good possessed by a user increases, you have additional units, the utility of the marginal unit decreases. Or, put differently, the more, as you acquire more units of a homogeneous good, you allocate each additional unit to an end that is successively lower ranked on the value scale. Okay, with each additional unit of wheat, I use it to satisfy a lower and lower valued end on my scale. Okay. Notice the insight that we have here. We're emphasizing discrete marginal units of goods, not abstract categories. Right, so the problem with diamonds and water is that valuation in an economic sense is not over water as an abstract category. How do I feel about water? Well, I like it. I mean, I think water is really important for life, blah, blah, blah. But I can't go out into the market and buy water in the abstract. Right? I can buy a bottle of water, or I can turn on the tap at home, and I can pay for a specific amount of water that flows through the pipes. Right? But I don't pay for water in the abstract. Likewise, markets don't value diamonds as a generic category. They value specific, discrete, marginal units of diamonds, right? But think about it from the point of view of diminishing marginal utility, right? How much water is there in the world? A lot, right? There is a lot of water such that for most people, in most circumstances, the value of a marginal unit of water is pretty low because they already have tons of units of water, right? You know, if I only have one unit of water, I drink it. If I have two units of water, I drink the first unit and I cook with the second unit. If I have three, I drink the first, cook with the second, water the plants with the third, and so forth. Right? I mean, if you only have two units of water to your name, they have a very high marginal utility, right? Because the utility of those first few units of water is very high. But when you get lots and lots and lots of them, the value of the marginal unit is low because you've already satisfied your highest and all of your highly ranked ends. But it's not so with diamonds. There are not very many of them. Most of us have control over one or two or maybe zero diamonds, so that the end to which a marginal diamond is put is very high. Right? It's very high on our value scale for diamonds. Okay. Again, this is all context specific. If you're in the middle of the Sahara Desert, the value of a gallon of water is very high. You might be in the Sahara Desert, with a sack full of diamonds, and you're about to, breathe your last breath, and the Culligan water man comes along and he offers to sell you a gallon of water for that whole sack of diamonds. You'd probably take the deal. You'd give him millions of dollars worth of diamonds to have that drink of water. Okay, for you in that situation, the price of water is greater than the price of diamonds, okay? But that's not the case for most of us because there's a lot of water and there's not very many diamonds. That's the solution to the paradox, to realize we're not pricing the thing in the abstract. We're pricing specific, discrete, marginal units. And the price that they command on the market depends on the quantity of units that is available to be transacted, okay? What Austrians mean by total utility is the marginal utility of an entire stock of the good that's within an actor's control, right? So, if Robinson Crusoe has six sacks of wheat, we can say the total utility of that six, of all six of those sacks, is, the benefits from being able to satisfy all six of those wants. So there is, something you might call a law of total utility. Simply the idea that a larger supply of a good has a greater utility than a smaller supply, right? So the utility of seven sacks of wheat is greater than the utility of six sacks of wheat, six sacks of wheat, simply because if we have seven, there's one more end that we can satisfy that we couldn't have satisfied if we had only six, okay? Now, I have a few slides in my notes about kind of neoclassical economics, about indifference curves. Why don't Austrians use indifference curves? But I'm just going to skip that in the interest of time, and we can certainly come back and talk about that in the Q&A if you want, or you can talk to me offline about that. But I do want to throw it open now for questions. So key takeaways from our discussion here. We're interested in action man. Mises and Rothbard called him acting man, but that's because they didn't know about these action figures. Action man, we're always interested in action here. Remember, this is causal realist economics. So the notion of what is an economic good, what is production, what is utility, and so forth, these are defined not mathematically, right, but in terms of cause and effect. Utility, value, benefit is purely subjective, meaning in the mind of the actor. And by the way, in the 19th century, in early 20th century, many economists referred to the Austrian school, and especially some of the adherents of the Austrian school outside of Austria, as being part of the psychological school. And that term's a little confusing today because people think about, you know, behavioral economics and the psychology of decision making. All that was meant in those days was that the Austrians and their followers emphasized, you know, the what's in the person's mind, right? It's the subjective valuations of consumers that ultimately drive the economic process, okay? And of course, we're interested in specific, discrete units of goods and services, not broad aggregate categories, okay? Let me stop there and address some of the questions that people have entered into the Q&A window, see if I can make it a little bit bigger here. I'll address as many of these as we have time for. We're supposed to stop at 8 o'clock Eastern. We can run over a few minutes later if people want. And of course, you can contact me privately if you have, or post to the in the discussion threads on the Moodle page if you want to follow up on any particular issue. So give me just a moment here to kind of scan through the questions and figure out which ones I want to answer. Okay, there's some questions that are pretty general that I think we've touched on already. For example, someone asked, "What is it that economists study? Don't economists study preferences?" And the answer is yes, but indirectly. What we study is action, and we infer preferences from action, rather than studying preferences and trying to predict action on the basis of those preferences. That's what a lot of neoclassical economists do, by the way. There are also some questions on here that I think I don't want to answer tonight. Somebody's asking, how does Obamacare violate the presuppositions and practices of the Austrian theory of human action? I don't think we really have time to go through all of that. We'll save that for another day. Here's a question about, I will address this. Somebody else is asking, the same questioner, how do concepts like marginal utility and total utility and so on apply to things like healthcare? Can we gain any insight into the market for medical services and all this controversy in the U.S. about healthcare and, of course, in other countries too? I will say this. I do think there is some insight in the following sense. The debate in the U.S. over the Obama administration's preferred alternative, so-called Affordable Care Act, versus other people's proposals and so on, it's often framed this way. Many Americans do not have health care. They don't have health insurance. We don't have at least a formal national health service, kind of de facto we do, but with emergency room care. But people say, well, in the U.S., some people don't have health insurance. They can't afford to go to the hospital. So some people don't have health care. We need legislation. We need the government to do something to make sure that everybody has health care. Now, from Carl Menger's point of view, that is absolutely the wrong way to approach this issue. Why? Because health care is not an economic good. Health care is an extremely broad and heterogeneous category. Okay? If I, while I'm walking to my car on the way home from the office just now, if I fall on the ground and I get a little scratch on my finger, but then I go to my car, and in the glove compartment, there's a first aid kit. I take out a Band-Aid, and I put it on my finger. Problem solved. I mean, do I have health care? I mean, suppose I don't have any health insurance. I can't afford to go to the doctor. I couldn't deal with cancer. But if I get a little boo-boo on my finger, I can put a Band-Aid on it. Does that mean I have health care, or I don't have health care? Okay, well, let's say I have enough money to go to the doctor, but I don't have insurance, or my insurance doesn't cover catastrophic care, then do I have health care or not? Well, I mean, even simply to ask the question, shows how silly the question is. Right? I mean, healthcare is not a homogeneous blob. There are things like, you know, there are band-aids, and there are medicines, and there are medical treatments, and there's diet and nutrition, you know, education. All of these things are part of health and well-being and nutrition and quality of, you know, longevity and quality of life and so forth. You know, we can buy and sell band-aids. We can buy and sell visits to the doctor. We can buy and sell medicines. We can buy and sell pieces of medical equipment. But there's no such thing as healthcare to be debated over, right? So the issue on the table is, you know, how do markets for specific healthcare goods and services and nutritional goods and services work? What are the markets like? What are the prices? How does government intervention in these markets affect them and so forth? But the notion of having healthcare or not having healthcare or access to healthcare or not is just simply meaningless from a causal realist point of view, right? So, I mean, there's no way to say this person has healthcare, this person doesn't have healthcare. We all have access to varying degrees of medical services. I mean, do I have automobile? Do I have access to automobile services? Well, you know, I really want that Bugatti that I saw in Beverly Hills, but I don't have it. I can't afford a Bugatti. Does that mean I don't have automobile service? Well, of course not. I mean, I have access to another car. You know, I drive another car. Is it as good as a Bugatti? Not in my subjective opinion, dang it. And so, well, oh, yeah, but come on, a car is just, in terms of basic transportation, Klein, you're perfectly set. Well, I mean, first of all, who's to say what my, why am I only allowed a preference for basic transportation and not fancy transportation? And how basic does it have to be? Well, it has to be reliable. What does that mean? That means never ever in the shop? No. I have Japanese. I have a Japanese automobile because I want reliability. It doesn't mean it's never in the shop. It just means it's more reliable than, you know, say an Italian car, which spends most of its time in the shop. Okay, how many days in the shop before it's reliable as opposed to unreliable? How basic or fancy can it be? I mean, does it have to have air conditioning to be considered reliable transportation, adequate transportation? These are dumb questions, right? There is a huge variety of different kinds of transportation services, everything from roller skates to bicycles to Toyotas to Bugattis to Learjets and so forth. And not everybody has the same kind. Some of them are inexpensive. Some of them are very expensive. People exchange them. People decide how much of their income they want to allocate to transportation services of one kind over another. Yeah, this all gets worked out in the market pretty well. There's absolutely no reason ex ante to think that, you know, healthcare goods and services cannot also be allocated in markets the same way. Does it mean that everybody would have access to the exact same medical goods and services? Well, of course not. But people don't have access to the exact same goods and services in any category. And by the way, this applies to education too, but that's a rant for another day. I'm going to go back and look at some other questions here. Okay, somebody is asking me about Mises' concept of time versus Einstein's. I'm not sure I really understand what that question means, so if that questioner would like to rephrase it, maybe I'll take another stab at it. There's a really good question here about the entrepreneur. How does what the entrepreneur does in forecasting, cost accounting, and so forth differ from what a neoclassical economist does in approaching economic issues and predicting behavior? Let me answer in the following way. For a neoclassical economist, what an economist does and what a forecaster or an entrepreneur or a historian does are exactly the same thing. Right? In other words, you know, forecasters try to predict how people will behave. I'm reading a fascinating book that I might talk about later that deals with the movie industry and how movie executives, you know, the director delivers a rough cut And they have a test screening. They show it to test audiences who fill out questionnaires, do interviews, and so forth. And the executives try to predict how well the movie will be received. And then they do some editing, and they decide how to do the marketing campaign, and so forth. So entrepreneurs are always trying to predict human decision making. Forecasters are trying to predict prices, trying to predict what the market will do. For an economist, according to Mises, for Mises, economics is not about prediction. It's not about forecasting. It's about, if you like, understanding or making sense of or interpreting the phenomena that we see around us. When we see, you know, diamonds, a little diamond going for $10,000 and a bottle of water going for $1, we want to try to make sense of that. Why is that the case? Right? How can we logically, deductively, you know, think of a way to explain that? Right? What can we infer about people's preferences? How can we make sense of these observations that we have made? That's Menger's notion of causal realist analysis. That's Mises' praxeology. But having that general insight does not enable you to predict exactly what a specific person will do in any specific set of circumstances. As economists, we're unable to do that. But as a practical matter, business people, entrepreneurs, you know, they try to predict all the time. Right? I mean, we watch people who go to the supermarket, and if they most of the time pick bananas when they could have picked coconuts, we anticipate or predict that they probably will choose coconuts tomorrow. Bananas tomorrow. But notice that's not necessarily a very precise quantitative prediction. It may be a loose, intuitive, qualitative prediction. It may be, you know, think of it as a conjecture that may or may not be right. But this is certainly what people, there's nothing illegitimate about that activity, but it is not the same thing as doing economic theory or economic analysis more more specifically. Another one of Mises' unusual terms is what he called thymology, T-H-Y-M-O-L-O-G-Y. That's sort of Mises' term for doing interpretive economics or, you know, historical economics, looking at the choices that real people actually made in the past in real situations and trying to make sense of them. And, you know, just as in my example at the beginning of the lecture of the Martian observing the stock exchange, right, just as the basic concepts of buying and selling and, you know, bidding and asking and so forth, just as you couldn't interpret the scene without reference to those basic concepts first, likewise, according to Mises, you cannot do good forecasting, you cannot do good historical analysis without first having the basic logical concepts of scarcity, choice, valuation, you know, marginal utility, demand, production, other concepts that we're going to get to in the next few weeks. Without having those concepts in mind first, there's no way to make any sense of the behavior that we see in the real world, and there's no way to predict how people will behave in the future. Okay? So, you know, economic theory, praxeology, is a prerequisite to doing the kind of doing sort of, you know, forecasting and predicting and so forth. It doesn't mean that a good forecaster, that a skilled entrepreneur, has to take a lot of formal courses in economics. It doesn't mean that an entrepreneur has to have read Human Action before they can be good at it. No, but intuitively what they're doing when they make their conjectures about future consumer behavior and so forth, they're implicitly using the basic concepts of valuation and preference and utility and so on that we've just been talking about, right? Another person has asked about further differences between neoclassical economics and Austrian economics. Again, I have a couple of slides on difference curves, which I didn't do in the interest of time, but that's an area, utility theory is an area in which I think there's a lot of confusion, and it's a little bit subtle. You know, at a superficial level, neoclassical economics and Austrian economics seems to there's a lot of overlap, right? So, you know, both groups use words like utility and marginal utility, and even if a good neoclassical economist will, of course, agree with the point that yes, utility is subjective. value subjective, and utility is ordinal, right? Sort of, you know, modern set, modern neoclassical choice theory that comes, analysis of choice that comes from set theory. Gerard Dubrou's book, Theory of Value, from 1959, is kind of the classic statement of this. It's also 100% ordinal, right? There are no utils. There's no adding up of utilities. So, you know, complaining that, well, neoclassical economics is silly because they believe there are things called utils, and, you know, the banana gives me 5 utils and the coconut only gives me 3 utils. No, I mean, mainstream economics doesn't really do that, at least it doesn't anymore. But they have a very different approach to analyzing choice, which I can describe in more detail. I actually even have a little article that I can circulate for those who are interested, kind of laying some of this out. But what neoclassical economists try to do is they imagine that you can describe a person's preferences not as they are manifest in action, but prior to action. But that preferences, or the utility function, as they might describe it, we can discuss that first, right? We can sort of construct that first, and then use this mental model of the actor, this model of the actor's valuation scales, to predict what the person will do in different circumstances. And if it doesn't predict well, then we have not designed the, we don't have the right utility function, right? And we can say that what a person does is, you know, rational or irrational based on whether it really does maximize their utility. Sort of in the Austrian context, there's no such thing as not maximizing your utility. It's just it's true by tautology that action is choosing the highest valued end. In neoclassical economics, you'd have a utility function that implies that under these particular circumstances, banana gives a higher utility than coconut, and we could imagine a person choosing coconut. And so they say, well, either they're crazy, they just had a momentary spasm where they decided to act irrationally, or we did something wrong with our, you know, we've messed up in our utility function. They really must have a different utility function in mind. For Austrians, valuation and action are just two different sides of the same coin. You know, as we get later on in the course to talk about pricing and market exchange and auctions and so on, you'll see many areas where there are similarities, strong similarities between Austrian and kind of more mainstream approaches, but many important differences as well. Can I explain 10 and 11? Somebody's asking about the two slides that I skipped, and the answer is no, I'm not going to do it now, but I will do it on another occasion. Okay, another question about time. Yeah, I'm going to have to think about that. There's some other question about prediction. I mean, is there prediction in Austrian economics? Yes, in a certain sense, right? But the kinds of predictions that are offered by Austrian price theory are, you know, again, they're very general qualitative predictions, right? We haven't gotten to demand theory yet. We'll talk about this in the next 2 weeks. But, you know, Austrians believe in, you know, downward sloping demand curves. If you think about a visual graphical representation of demand theory, or put more precisely, there is what Austrians consider the law of demand is the idea that, you know, for a given unit of a good or service, right, the quantity of that good or service demanded on the market goes down when the price goes up. Or rather, to get people, as the price of a good or service goes down, the quantity, the number of units that will be consumed goes up. The inverse relationship between price and the quantity demanded. If you want to say that's a prediction, well, my prediction is other things equal, at a higher price, a lower quantity will be demanded of, pens. At a higher price of pens, a lower quantity of pens will be demanded. That's my prediction. Okay, well, that's not a very useful prediction if I'm a pen entrepreneur. I want to know, you know, if the price goes up by 2 cents, will the quantity demanded in the city of Columbia, Missouri, go down by 5, by 500, by 5,000, how long will it take, and so forth. You know, the law of demand, as understood by Menger and his successors, does not allow us to give that kind of quantitative prediction. And also, you know, there's also the other things equal requirement. Other things equal, if the price goes down, the quantity will go up. Yeah, but in the real world, other things aren't equal. There may simultaneously be a change in people's preferences, a change in the overall economic conditions in the city, and so forth. In doing an applied study, we'd have to think, well, what's really going on with those things? Were other things really being held equal, or were there other changes that we need to take into account, and so forth? Okay. Okay, I think it's a little bit after 8 o'clock Eastern, so we kind of need to wrap it up. I'm just going to take a quick little glance at the chat window to see if there's anything else I want to comment on. Lots of good stuff going on here. Let's see. Okay, and there's a good discussion about ordinal versus cardinal rankings, and whether you can use mathematical operators and so forth. I mean, look, there's certainly a lot of controversy about the use of mathematics in economics. Well, you know, in Austrian economics, and most mainstream economists use a lot of math. Why don't Austrians use math? I mean, I want to suggest for most of what we'll discuss in our course that a lot of these arguments are kind of more heat than light, or there's more smoke than fire. So, I mean, look, causal realist analysis does not generally lend itself to a mathematical exposition. There may be cases where, you know, mathematical examples can help to illustrate the point, where particular kinds of diagrams, where we look at the shape of the curve or the slope of the curve, may be helpful to explicate, to communicate, to clarify a particular point. But Austrians do not think that it is in any way necessary to use mathematical analysis, you know, to sort of think through a particular problem. And indeed, for most economic problems, it's simply impossible to express it in mathematical terms, because human action is essentially subjective, ordinal, qualitative, and so forth. It's not that Austrians have kind of an aversion to math for stylistic reasons, that they're afraid of math, or that they worry that, you know, using math makes it look like you have physics envy or something like that. I mean, that isn't intrinsic to the issue here at all. I mean, as a historical footnote, a lot of well-known Austrian economists had been quite good at math. I mean, Murray Rothbard was a math major at Columbia as an undergrad. So it isn't that Austrians don't understand math, or that they just have a subjective dislike of math. It's that mathematical language, you know, often obfuscates rather than clarifies. It misleads us to thinking about things that we shouldn't be thinking about. There are a lot of hidden assumptions that are smuggled in about the nature of, you know, preferences, and continuity and differentiability and so forth, tangencies, etc., infinitesimally small units that either do not apply to human action or mislead us into focusing on peripheral issues rather than the central ones. So it doesn't mean that Austrian economists might not use mathematical illustrations. It just means that mathematics is neither necessary nor, in most cases, even relevant for analyzing the kinds of problems that we want to analyze. Okay, it's 10 after 8 Eastern, so I think we ought to stop. I'm going to go ahead and call our proceedings to a close, but please indicate in the discussion threads on Moodle what else you'd like to talk about. Of course, you can email me if you have a question about anything specific. If you want to know more about indifference curves, maybe we can arrange that as a little private Skype chat for those who really, really want to know. But otherwise, I will see you guys same time next week. So thanks a lot for coming tonight. And Danny, I think we can stop the recording.